Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 311. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about box jellyfish, crocodiles, and tree kangaroos as we go to northern Queensland in Australia. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Before we get into this week's interview, I do have three news stories for you. In the first one, it is legal to take cupcakes on planes, but if you're buying cupcake in a jar, and there is such a product, I was surprised to find out, that is not legal because this jar is filled with icing and the icing is classified as a gel. If you have to keep it in a jar, consider it a liquid and don't bring it on the plane. And then if you're looking for a good time to fly when you'll find extra seats, you might try Friday the 13th. A story that came out in the Daily Mail that bookings on Friday the 13th last time fell about 24%. So the planes may not be quite as crowded if you're not quite as superstitious. And then a new use for something old. A Chinese company has bought an old Russian aircraft carrier and turned it into, wait for it, a luxury hotel. The aircraft carrier Kiev was built in 1972 and was purchased by China in 1996, is now part of the Binhai Aircraft Military Themed Park in Tianjin. It's been turned into 137 standard hotel rooms, 3 VIP guest rooms, 2 presidential suites, and a luxury restaurant. And hey, if you want to land your private jet, they might be able to accommodate you. For links to all three of those stories, check out the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. I'd like to welcome to the show Dave Kerwin, who's coming to us from Chicago and come to talk to us about northern Queensland. Dave, welcome to the show.
Hi, Chris. Thank you.
And I say northern Queensland, but you have a particular name that you say the guidebooks use for this particular region of Queensland.
Yeah, I'd like to call the area the Daintree. That is what the predominant national park goes by. It's called the Daintree. Daintree also refers to a city in the area that we'll be talking about, as well as a major river. So there's a good reason to call it the Daintree.
Okay. And when we're putting this on the map, we're doing northeastern Australia.
Yeah, absolutely. This is far northern Queensland. It's sort of the area around Cairn or Cairn. And it's sort of west and north of that. I'm trying to pronounce it in both ways.
And just so you know, because Dave and I talked about this afterwards, if he slips in and calls it Cairns, that's because that's the way it's spelled. If we call it Cairns, that's because that's closer to the local pronunciation to the extent that either one of us can do an Australian accent.
That's true. I'm from Chicago, so Cairn is going to be my natural, I think. I apologize to everybody from Cairn.
And actually, the very, very first show of the Amateur Traveler, if you go back and find episode 1, or maybe it's episode 2, we talked about Cairns, and we talked about my particular trip there. So we're going back to Queensland after quite some time, but you got a chance to see more than I did in that area. What kind of itinerary would you recommend?
Yeah, so what I would recommend, the way I like to think about the area is in 3 distinct pieces. I think of directly south and west of Cairn. I think of the Atherton Tablelands area as a very important part of the trip. Then I would head north into the Daintree itself to the city of Daintree. I think that's a great location to base a visit to the area. And then the third area that I would cite, the reefs, of course, because one of the really special things about this area, far northern Queensland, is as we talk about this further, the Great Barrier Reef actually runs into mainland Queensland in the Daintree Raintree National Forest. So it's natural to extend the trip and to include some diving or snorkeling as well.
Okay. And just setting a expectation for people, we're not talking about neither the most heavily populated part of Australia nor the least populated part of Australia either.
That's definitely true. This is very far north in Queensland. I mean, southern Queensland has a lot more, major cities. These are pretty small cities we're talking about.
Okay. And let's go back and do that a little bit slower. So you started us in the Atherton Tablelands.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So my recommendation, I guess what I did, I arrived into the Cairn Airport, and then I rented a car. I know one of the things you like to talk about, Chris, is how to get around an area. Mm-hmm. And this particular area, I have to recommend a car because it's really the only option I found. It's not a train area, or there are some buses, but they're pretty sporadic. So I would recommend a car. And that allows you to drive from the coastal Queensland up into the Atherton Tablelands. This is basically a vertical drive up the, I'm going to call it the mountains, but it's technically a tablelands, a high plateau above the coast.
Okay. And why are we going there?
Okay, yeah. So the reason that I find this area the most interesting is for absolutely the wildlife. So I'm a big animal enthusiast myself, and obviously one of the primary reasons I was in Australia was to see Australian wildlife. So we're talking about marsupials. But the thing that's really special about the Atherton Tablelands is the monotreme population. And so the monotremes are the egg-laying mammals. This is specifically the platypus. Yeah, and the echidna. So the Atherton Tablelands, and specifically the town of Yungaburra in the Atherton Tablelands, are really well known as a great place to go to see platypus. So this is how I found my way there, by looking for where the best density of platypus are.
Now, is it platypus, platypuses, or platypi?
It is platypus.
Okay, all right.
And anyway, so the Atherton Tablelands are also known for tree kangaroos, which of course are kangaroos that live in trees.
Well, before you get into your tree kangaroos, did you see platypus?
Yes, I did. So I went there thinking that this was going to be a really big challenge, you know, that it was going to be the most difficult thing in the world to see. And the simple reality is that kind of every little pond or river in the area is a home for one or more of the platypus. They were actually quite easy to see. They are very shy. They're only around in the morning. But I hardly even had to get up very early to see them. They were just sort of around. Really surprising to me, right in downtown Yungaburra. Yungaburra is a very, very small town. When I say downtown, I really mean a crossroads with a pub. But right next to this pub, there is a platypus viewing area. Cars are driving through the area, but there are platypus swimming around in the river right off this bridge.
Okay. And the platypus being such a strange animal that, as I recall, when they sent back stuffed platypuses to England, they thought it was a hoax.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
They had to send back a live platypus before people believed that this duck-billed, beaver-tailed, egg-laying mammal was actually a real thing.
Yeah, they are also, they have the distinction of being the world's only poisonous mammal. So that's pretty strange.
When you say poisonous, you mean venomous.
Venomous.
Correct. And I did not know that.
Yeah, they are venomous. The males have stingers on their hind legs.
Really?
Yeah. They have their spurs. They're sort of like a spur on their, where their elbow joint would be on their back leg.
Okay. I have newfound respect for the platypus.
All right. Sorry. I'm sorry. I'm getting too into the... I warned you that I was in this region for the wildlife.
Hey, I like being surprised. So, and then you mentioned tree-going kangaroos.
Yeah, tree kangaroos, they are called. Yes. So again, in the town of Yungaburra, it is known for tree kangaroos. Chris, I know you've been to Australia. So one of the things that I enjoyed about Australia was, as you drive around on the roads, you see these really cute signs, you know, like kangaroo crossing signs, cassowary crossing signs. Well, one of my favorite things about Yungaburra is they have a tree kangaroo crossing sign, which I thought was really polite to the tree kangaroo population.
Now, I'm having a little trouble picturing a tree kangaroo because I've seen kangaroos and I've been up close to kangaroos, and they tend to have these great big powerful hind legs and really almost useless front legs. So does a tree kangaroo just hop into the tree, or does it have more noticeable front legs that it can climb with?
Yeah, so a tree kangaroo is much smaller than kind of the giant red kangaroos you see hopping around.
So it's more like a wallaby.
It is. They're more the size of a wallaby.
Okay.
And they have tails that allow them to balance and position themselves in the tree. And they do use their tails while they're climbing around. But they do, I have seen them hop along a tree branch as a regular kangaroo would hop along on the ground.
Hmm.
But they entirely live in the trees. They only come down to find other kangaroos.
I know when we were in Cairns, we went to the tropical zoo there and saw kangaroos there. And we were in there with our kangaroo food, feeding what we thought was a small kangaroo and was actually a wild wallaby, because they have, I think, 6-foot fences around the place, but 6-foot fences don't keep out a kangaroo or a wallaby.
Yeah, the wild ones are very hard to tell from the tame ones. That was what I found.
Okay. And what else are we going to see in the Tablelands area while we're up there?
Okay, yeah. So there are some other things. It's not just about the...
The venomous mammals and hopping marsupials, okay?
Right, right. There are a number of crater lakes in the area.
Mm-hmm.
Yungaburra actually sits on a large crater lake, and this is a good place to go for sightseeing. There are a number of waterfalls in the area, and the crater lake itself is also home... I guess I'm going back to animals again, Chris. But it's home to a lot of the amethystine python, which is the largest python in Australia. So there were quite a number of these in the area the day we were there, which was pretty great to see. Again, if you're into snakes.
I don't know if you've read Bill Bryson's book, In a Sun-Drenched Country, about Australia, but the thing that stands out for me about Australia after reading his book is how many things there can kill you.
Well, the pythons are, they're probably the least of the worries, but yeah, these aren't poisonous at least.
And you mentioned crater lakes. Crater as in volcanic crater, crater as in meteor crater, or as in sinkhole, or as in just round thing with water in it?
Yeah, so my understanding is they were formed from some sort of a meteor strike.
Hmm.
I'm not going to pretend I'm an expert on what the nature of it was, but it was formed based on a meteor that fell to Earth and created this crater in the Tablelands.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay, and then anything else we should see there before we move on to the Daintree National Park?
So there is a large lake right next to Yungaburra as well. This is called Lake Tinaroo. And right at the southern edge of Lake Tinaroo, there are a couple of very large strangler fig trees that are worth seeing. They're called Cathedral and Curtain fig tree.
And unlike the python, they're not really going to strangle me.
No, okay. No, not at all. These are strangler figs, of course, that grow over thousands of years from the top of a tree.
Oh, okay. So these are succulents. They're growing on top of another tree.
Yes, exactly. They start at the top of the tree. They drop their root system down the tree, and sort of over hundreds of years, they sort of steal all the nutrients and they strangle the host tree. As the tree ages and the original tree dies, it leaves sort of a curtain or a oddly shaped shell around, leaving a space in the center where the host tree had been.
Hmm, interesting.
That's how the curtains formed, yeah. There was a great, actually, in one of the guidebooks I read, they called it like something out of a Lord of the Rings movie. And I think that was specifically about the curtain fig tree. And I found that to be a great description, so I thought I'd steal it.
And which guidebook were you using?
That was a Lonely Planet guidebook. Okay. I used a few guidebooks. That was specifically from a Lonely Planet.
And since you mentioned guidebook, you know that I have to ask, were there things that you were recommended to go by the guidebook that you would not recommend?
Well, yeah, so I guess my overall take on the guidebooks for the Atherton Tablelands and the Daintree, I have a rough guide. I have it in front of me. And I look at this book. It's a 1,200-page guidebook, and they devoted exactly 4 pages to both the Atherton Tablelands and the Daintree area. So my opinion is that this area is a wonderful area worth going to see, and that they really shorted the whole section, the whole region of the Atherton Tablelands. It's given about a paragraph here.
Hmm.
So that would be the take I have. This is probably a year-old guidebook, but I think it's still accurate.
Okay. And then speaking of the Daintree...
Oh, yeah, right. So then what I would do is I would take my car and I would drive north, leaving the Atherton Tablelands, and head into the Daintree. This drive, I guess, it took us like maybe 3 to 4 hours. We drove very slow and stopped a number of times along the way. So the town of Port Douglas would be the destination you're going for.
Mm-hmm.
So you're driving from Yungaburra to Port Douglas. And from Port Douglas, then, you head north into the Daintree National Park. But I did want to mention one thing along that drive. I guess you kind of reminded me of it, Chris. There are a couple of things to stop and see along that drive. Mm-hmm. The first would be a place called Granite Gorge. Now, Granite Gorge is sort of, I guess it's a tourist attraction. What you do is you pull into a car park, and they have a kind of an area with some scenic rocks, and they have kind of a guided trail you walk around. But the primary reason to go there is because the area is populated by wild rock wallabies. They are wild. They're not caged in, but you can feed them. And if there's a difference between a wild and a tame wallaby, I don't know what it is, because these were completely wild, but they would eat out of your hand. They're very well fed, but it was pretty nice to see them. That was worth doing, I thought. The other thing is you pass through a town called Mareeba that has a large wetland park that's home to a lot of birds. So it's sort of a birding area.
Okay.
But I think moving along to the Daintree is probably a good idea now. So the way I view the Daintree is it's an area north of Port Douglas. There's sort of two separate national parks that make up Daintree National Park. And in between these two halves of the national parks, there is the Daintree River. And on the Daintree River sits the town of Daintree. This is where I chose as my base. There are a few hotels in the area, but it's a pretty good place because getting into the Daintree is a little challenging, and it's a long drive from anywhere else to be able to spend a full day in the National Forest itself.
Okay. And Daintree, I gather, is a relatively small town.
Daintree is an extremely small town. It's maybe a couple blocks by a couple blocks. There are two restaurants. There is a gift shop kind of a place that really serves as a tourist shop to pick up brochures and book river tours. River tours in the area are popular because you can take a river tour up the Daintree River. And the advantage of doing that is to see the saltwater crocodiles.
I was going to say, yes.
Okay. So you don't want to do this on your own is mm-hmm. what I'm saying. You want to go with the guide who knows what he's doing. Yeah. The saltwater crocodiles, of course, they can be 18 to 20 feet long. They're very large.
And since crocodiles live in the river, I'm going to guess that the river's fairly cloudy.
Yeah. Oh, it's extremely cloudy. It's very, very dark. It's a very large river. So one of the things I did when I was there are a large number of tour companies, but I specifically took a river tour with a guy named Dan Irby, who lives in Daintree today, but he is originally from Oklahoma, and he's a very experienced guy. So I would like to give him a shout out.
Excellent. And I was asking whether it was a cloudy river because according to the crocodile expert at the Cairns Tropical Wild Animal Park, the crocodile won't attack you if it can see you because it hunts by surprise and by ambush. Now, I'm not sure that I'd really want to put that to the test with the size of some of these very large saltwater crocodiles in that area, but
no. In this whole area, some of the rivers are saltwater rivers and some mm-hmm. of them are freshwater rivers. And every river that I saw, most of them were marked or locals could tell you if they were saltwater or freshwater. The difference is that the saltwater rivers, they're dangerous because crocodiles could be in them.
Okay. So in the Daintree National Park itself, is there opportunities for hiking, or what are you doing in the park itself?
Okay, yeah. To me, the entrance to the Daintree National Park is one of the great sights in the area, in my opinion. Maybe this is a little nerdy, but what you do is many people take day trips from Port Douglas. If you drive from Daintree, doesn't matter. The only way into the Daintree National Forest from the south is to cross the Daintree River, and the way to cross the Daintree River is by way of a cable ferry. So there's a car ferry.
So it's a single car ferry pulled across on a cable?
It will pull something like, I did count when I was there, but my memory's failing me, maybe 12 cars.
Okay. All right.
It held. It's a large barge that's pulled across by a cable, but this was a really, really cool thing to see. Very, very medieval, maybe? You're taking your horses across the river to the other side. Anyway, I thought it was a really, really great experience. And because you can't just drive back and forth, it really limits the number of people who are then in on the north side of the Daintree National
right.
Forest. Yeah. That's a good thing, I guess, in terms of your wildlife sighting and other things, right?
And I would think by the time you're all the way up in Port Douglas, you've also limited the tourists quite a lot. That every time you go further north here, you're leaving more and more of the tourists behind.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true.
Okay. Yep. And then you finally get to the park, the northern part of the park, and you've gone there, I'm going to guess, to see wild animals.
Of course. Yeah, so the idea here, the northern half of the Daintree National Park is also referred to as Cape Tribulation. So the Daintree National Park is one of these parks where you start at the south end and you drive, and your goal is the drive because there's many things to see along it. But your goal at the end of the road where you turn around and come back is most likely Cape Tribulation. This is an important place that I'll get to in a moment, but it's also where the paved road ends. So that's where I stopped.
For which your rental car company thanks you.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, we won't mention that. But yeah, exactly. The idea, though, is you drive along this route, and there's a number of things to see along the way. Along the drive, there's a number of pull-offs where you can access the beach. Mm-hmm. Cow Bay would be a great example of that. That's a really beautiful beach area for swimming or whatever you like. But there's also a number of boardwalks and kind of cut paths. The Daintree National Forest, I guess, is one of the world's oldest rainforests, I guess. The reason for that, I'm not really a botanist, but from what I've learned about it, the reason it's cited as, the forest is very, very old, and it features a plant called the cycad, C-Y-C-A-D. And this is a plant that's been around since the time of the dinosaurs. So it's sort of an ancient fern species.
Hmm.
So that's sort of what you're there to see. You're there to see the forest itself and then the animals that live in the forest, of course. And one of the most famous animals from this region is the cassowary, the large bird with the kind of bluish ornamentation on its head. Yeah, that's one of the things you're looking for on this drive. I personally was not lucky enough to see one, but I spent a lot of time trying.
And a cassowary is similar to an emu, I believe. It's a flightless bird.
It is. It's in that family with the ostrich and the emu. They are smaller and they're also more colorful. And the other difference is they live in the rainforest. So they are a rainforest bird. And yeah.
Okay. I had to look it up. I was cheating while I did that.
Okay. Yeah, no worries. Of course. Yeah. So along this drive, there are a few places to stop to eat, but basically you're going to spend your whole day driving to Cape Tribulation. So the great thing about Cape Tribulation, if we move along on the drive to there, the most famous thing that you'll read about Daintree, if you do a 2-minute Google search probably, is you're going to read that this is the place, this is one of the couple places on Earth where the beach meets the reef. So what you see on Cape Tribulation itself is you'll see coral from the Great Barrier Reef growing right up onto the beach where the sand is. You can walk out to it. You could stand on it. You can take your picture on it.
Not that we would encourage you to stand on the coral, but...
Of course not. There is a lot of wildlife living on the coral. Mm-hmm. And you can see all this, of course, without walking on the coral. You can see a lot of sea slugs, sea cucumbers living in it, a lot of crabs. Oh, and the other thing that's at Cape Tribulation, I guess since we're on this wildlife kick, is there is a pretty good population of monitor lizards that live in the area.
Interesting.
Yeah.
When you were saying where the reef meets the beach, I don't know that everyone has the mental picture here, but the reef is fairly far offshore. Basically, you can take a boat out to the reef to go diving, and you're usually, I think from Cairns, for instance, you're going out at least an hour by boat, and then some people actually go out by helicopter, so it'd be a much faster trip.
Yeah, absolutely. The Great Barrier Reef covers the eastern coast of Australia from this area all the way down to Brisbane, and this is where it gets closest to the shore.
Hmm.
Even in the Port Douglas area, I did a diving trip, and I was on a boat for 2 hours to get to... That was some of the outlying reefs that had some more interesting sights, I guess. It's an hour to 2 hours offshore. And Port Douglas is only maybe... if you're racing and you're driving fast, you could make it there in maybe 2-3 hours. It's a 2-hour drive from Daintree.
From Daintree, okay.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure which end of the road you were starting on. Okay.
No, from Daintree to Port Douglas is about a 2-hour drive.
Okay.
From Cape Tribulation, you add a little bit more time because it's a smaller, winding, scenic road.
And you've mentioned driving, and I'm really surprised. Recently, there was a poll that happened on Amateur Traveler, and I was talking to people about places they would go, but they were afraid to. And the number one place that came up was Australia. And it wasn't the pythons or the venomous platypuses, but it was the flight, most of all, just the length of the flight. And then I think the other thing I hear that people are afraid of is driving on the other side of the road.
Okay, that's a really good point. Yeah, the driving is on the other side of the road. You wouldn't want to drive like you would drive in Chicago or Mountain View. It's the other side of the road. That's absolutely true.
Did you find either one to be something that would keep you from going back?
No, not at all. I mean, I spent a couple weeks there. I drove the whole time I was there. Mm-hmm. I didn't really have a problem with it. I did find the driving in from Cannes up to the Atherton Tablelands, Yungaburra. We arrived on a flight in the evening, and it was kind of sun was setting, and we did this drive in the night, and basically in total darkness.
Ah, that I would not recommend. I wouldn't recommend getting off the flight and right into a car in the dark. No.
Yeah, that I think could have been planned better. And it was really, I think I joked earlier about how it was a vertical drive. That was the scars of that drive kind of coming back to me when I joked about how it was a vertical drive. It really was straight uphill in the dark. So yeah, other than that, I it wouldn't have even occurred to me to mention it as a problem.
And because you didn't mention it, that's why I wanted to point out to people who may be afraid of doing that, that it's amazing how quickly you adjust. Now, you do have to be careful every time you get in the car. I know my uncle, every time he's here, my uncle who lived in Australia for years, every time he was here, he would try and get in the driver's side when I was driving. But you figured out relatively quickly. I think most people do. But I wouldn't try it at night, first of all.
Yeah. That's true.
And then you mentioned the reef. You did get out a chance to get out to the reef from Port Douglas. So you took a dive trip.
Yeah, I did. What I did was I chose to stay in Daintree, as I guess I've already mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Because of the plentitude of hotels there.
Yeah, there's a couple hotels there. Yeah. Actually, there's very, very small number. There's three that I'm aware of. And then there's one a little further south in the Mossman Gorge area, which I guess is really actually another area I should mention. But yes, I did do a day trip. I got up very early in the morning. I drove myself down to Port Douglas, and I hooked up with a company that does reef trips. Obviously, what I wanted to do was get myself on a boat that supplied the scuba tanks.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you have done scuba before?
I have, yeah. I am not a licensed scuba diver. I have done it a number of times. They required that I do it with a guide, which really, to be honest, was absolutely fine with me because I'm not a licensed diver. I don't do it, you know, every day. I live in Chicago. I don't live near a beach, so.
And Lake Michigan, not known for its scuba.
Right. That is correct. Yeah. So I did. I went out on a dive with a company called Aristocap. And one of the things I would recommend to your listeners, Chris, there's a couple things. The first thing is I was there in July, which, of course, is the Australian
winter time.
It's the Australian winter. And one of the reasons I went there during the winter time was because this is when the stinger jellyfish are not there.
The box jellyfish.
Yeah, exactly. The box jellyfish, of course.
Yeah, one more thing in Australia that can kill you. Okay.
Yeah, they're actually extremely dangerous,
right.
And they swarm the entire area in the Australian summer. So that would be the December, January timeframe.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can, of course, wear stinger jellyfish or box jellyfish proof suits, diving suits. I thought it was better to avoid this whole thing. So that's one of the reasons I was there in July.
Well, my understanding is in terms of protecting yourself from box jellyfish, it's not that hard in the sense that people have been known, even guys, to go down to the beach wearing pantyhose because even that much protection will protect you from the box jellyfish. Of course.
Oh, wow.
They will laugh at you, but on the other hand, if you do get stung, it's a fairly serious thing. So,
yeah, absolutely. I didn't want to see them, really, because it was a concern of mine. So anyway, I did then book a travel through a company called Aristocat, mm-hmm. and I sort of chose them because they have small boats, but they're one of a couple companies, that company and Wavelength, that are allowed to stop the boat if they see whales and allow people to dive with whales. There's a particular type of whale called the dwarf minke whale. They come through the barrier reef in the Port Douglas area in the July-August timeframe. And so this was one of the things I was looking for when I was there. We did not see any. We saw some humpback whales, but we did not see any of the dwarf minke whales. But this is also an advantage of being there during this time, as you have a good chance.
Okay. What was the biggest surprise of Queensland?
I would say from my perspective, which I guess I've already explained, was I was heavily focused on wildlife in this area. My biggest surprise was the ease of finding a lot of these very unusual mammals. I was walking back into my hotel one evening in Daintree, and we were walking on the driveway, and an echidna crossed our path. And the echidna just kind of walked around. It let us get within a few feet of it. I took some great pictures of it. But the wildlife is just everywhere and very, very accessible, I guess. And the platypus, again, as well. I was really, really surprised how easy it was to see the platypus.
Okay. And the best day of this whole trip?
Definitely any day you spend crossing the ferry and going into the Daintree National Forest. The way I would make that day the best is I would stop at as many boardwalks as possible. I would look for the reptile life, the cassowary, and then I would go up to Cape Tribulation, and then I would make sure to stop at a place called the Daintree Ice Cream Company that forgot to mention. So yeah, this is a really, really special place. It's very well known. Anybody who heads into the northern part of the Daintree National Park stops there. It's in all the books, but it is a really special place. What they do is they take like local fruits and vegetables and they turn it into ice cream, and it's all very, very exotic. And they kind of liken the ice cream to, they say this is kind of like chocolate, but obviously none of it is actually made from chocolate.
Okay, but made from local equivalents.
Yeah, it's made from local fruits, local berries, this kind of a thing.
Okay. And you mentioned guide. Who was the most memorable person you met?
So a person who was a really, really big help to me on my entire trip. So when I was in Chicago planning this trip, I met a fellow on the internet. I actually met him by way of his own website. His name is Alan Gillanders. And he is a native of Yungaburra, and he helped me a great deal. He actually recommended a hotel in Yungaburra for me. He's sort of a figure who's known to sort of people in the area. The hotel I stayed at in Daintree immediately knew who he was. I met him, and I actually had wanted him to take me out to see animals at night. It's difficult to see animals at night. I don't carry large spotlights with me. I can't see in the dark. So I thought a local guide would help. And while he did decline me because he wanted to go dancing with, I think he called her his honey, he wanted to go dancing, he did agree to meet me the next morning. And he took me out to find tree kangaroos, platypus. And I had a really nice time with him. But I really think what he did for me was he helped me a great deal before I even left the States with positioning myself in an area that I would maximize the number of animals I would see.
Excellent. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in Queensland?
I would say that I would have to go with the crocodiles. I know there are other areas in Australia, but the signs, every time you cross a bridge, there's a sign that says danger, saltwater crocodiles here, do not enter, swim at your own risk, this sort of thing. It's the signs. And then every beach you pull into, there are signs. There's a great sign depicting a box jellyfish stinging a person, warning you away from it.
Great.
Yeah. But these signs are great fun, I guess.
Okay. Oh, you mentioned one other place that you didn't cover, which was the Mossman
Gorge. Yeah.
Gorge.
Thank you so much, Chris. That would be a big thing to forget here. Right. So between Port Douglas and the city of Daintree itself, there's a place called the Mossman Gorge. It's, I guess, a historic area for the Aborigines who originally inhabited the place. But it's sort of a really nice area to go out and do a kind of walk on a boardwalk to see a small creek, I guess, winding through some really nice rocks. It's a very nice walk. And a very nice area to see some waterfalls and cascading water.
Okay.
Also, there aren't a lot of restaurants in the whole Daintree area, but one really excellent restaurant is inside a hotel, a very nice resort called the Silky Oaks Resort. They have a very, very nice restaurant, and it's sort of outdoor and overlooks a river in this area of the Mossman Gorge.
Okay. Excellent. Before we go to wrap this up, is there anything else you want people to know before they go to Queensland and especially up to the Daintree area?
I think the most important thing I can say is that you should go, even though it's only briefly mentioned in most of the books, in The Rough Guide and Lonely Planet. It is a very, very nice area. It is quiet. North of Port Douglas, there aren't a lot of nightclubs. There aren't a lot of restaurants. One thing that we found was that the restaurants closed by 8 or 9 o'clock. I mean, they literally shut down and you couldn't eat. There was nowhere to eat after that point. So it is sort of an early kind of place. It's a get up early in the morning, see wildlife, and everything shuts down when it's dark. Yeah.
So if you're the sort of person who thinks nightlife, when I say the word nightlife, you think of wildlife, this is the place for you. If you think disco or something like that, probably a different place.
Yeah, the Daintree, Atherton Table and area is not the right place for that. Probably more like Cairn and also Port Douglas would have more of that kind of thing.
Okay. Finish this thought for me. You really know you're in Queensland. You really know you're in the Daintree area when what?
Again, I'm going to go back to the wildlife, Chris. I mean, this is really probably one of the very few places in the world you can see the platypus, you can see the cassowary, and you can be in one of the world's oldest rainforests.
Excellent. And by the way, I did look it up, and there is no agreed upon plural for platypus. It is either platypuses or platypus, and less colloquially known, platypi. In case someone asks you.
There you go. Well, thank you.
If you had to summarize Northern Queensland in three words, what three words would you use?
Yeah, I'm going to say wildlife.
I saw that one coming. Okay.
You saw that one coming. And then rainforest and reef.
Excellent. Well, Dave, thanks so much for coming on The Amateur Traveler and telling us more about your love for Northern Queensland.
Hey, Chris, it's been an extraordinary pleasure. Thanks.
I had an odd but interesting day today as I was up in San Francisco as part of a casting call for a new show called Ford Escape Routes, sponsored by Ford. It's a web series from the producer of The Amazing Race. And I got called in by Ogilvy, the PR firm, as a consultant to help with the social media questions. Although really, most of the contestants didn't know anything about social media. That really wasn't that hard to figure out. But because of that, this show is coming out late, so we're going to skip the rest of the community news as I have to pack up to fly to Boston tomorrow. If you have any questions about this episode, feel free to leave a comment at amateurtraveler.com or send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Chris2X. And as always, thanks so much for listening.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.